Everyone agrees that we have entered into the information age. However, more and more experts are concluding that information is secondary to the ability to communicate that information in a useful and timely way. They are even saying that we have passed from the information age into the communications age. If you read the newspapers and look at all the controversy over the mergers and acquisitions of telecommunications and entertainment organizations, the rise of multimedia computing, and the advent of the 500 television station satellite dish, you can quite easily see that communications has become the major issue of our time. Hundreds of thousands of books and many millions of articles are being produced every year all over the world. It is no longer possible for anyone to keep current with all of the information or even a fraction of the information that affects their particular field or specialty. The average executive today spends between 2 and 3 hours simply reading material. The advent of email has now reached the point where many executives in large corporations are swamped with 2 or 3 hours of letters and memos on their computers, as well as all the other letters, magazines, reports, briefs, and memos they have to read to keep current with their work. Everyone who wants to stay ahead of the curve in the information or communication age has to become good at reading. This means that they have to become very proficient in selecting the material they read, in utilizing their time so that they can read the material that is most important to them, and in reading in such a way that they retain and remember the key facts they must have to do their work and live their lives in the best way possible. In this session, you're going to learn how to turn speed reading into power reading, and how to write and communicate on paper more effectively. Both of these skills require practice, but their payoff can be extraordinary. In session 10, we will talk about how to communicate more effectively, and people who can read, write, and speak effectively in the communications age will definitely lead the field. All around you today, you can see that the men and women who are doing the best and having the best lives are those who are the most fluent in reading, writing, and speaking. And it doesn't matter what your background or education has been up till now. These are skills like riding a bicycle that you can learn with study and practice. If you make the decision to become excellent in these areas and you practice the accelerated learning techniques that we've discussed in earlier sessions, it's absolutely inevitable that you become competent and capable and move to the top of your field. Let's start off with a simple question. Can you develop the capacity to speed read? Is it even worthwhile to be a speed reader? The first question is easy to answer. Yes, you can easily double, triple, or quadruple your reading speed. You can learn how to do this in less than 3 hours. The answer to the second question, is it worthwhile, is it depends. Speed reading is not desirable if comprehension is important to you. For you to comprehend, you must see and hear the words in your head. In order to really absorb important material, you need to learn power reading strategies, only one of which involves speed. Scientific or mathematics textbooks, for example, and even most serious business material, rarely lends itself to speed reading. Nor would you be able to use speed reading with a book or magazine containing many new ideas that require you to stop frequently and consider their implications. However, speed reading is a very useful skill when you are skimming and scanning material because it prevents you from getting bored as you quickly move through magazines and newspapers. Since your brain thinks faster than you read, there's too much temptation for your mind to wander when you read slowly. You keep it occupied by reading faster, and the faster you read, the more and better you concentrate. The reason that you read slower than you need to is because your eye takes in information faster than your ear. Yet most of us still want to hear the words in our mind as we read them, even if we don't need to. We may not literally subvocalize or murmur the words under our breath, but it produces the same result. You've heard the joke about the not very bright person who would only read until his lips got tired. When you insist on hearing each individual word in your head, you significantly slow down your reading. You can only hear words at approximately 250 words per minute, but you can see them at the rate of as many as 2,000 words a minute or more. With proper training, you can increase your ability to skim and scan newspapers and magazines to as high as 10,000 words per minute. And if you learn to read on a purely visual basis, you can rapidly increase the speed at which you cover information and assimilate material. Another problem that slows us down is that we usually insist on trying to see every word on the line. Yet there are an enormous number of redundant or filler words in English. For this reason, you don't have to see every word to make sense of the material you are reading. The mistake the average reader makes is to read words individually. It's not normally the individual words that matter. It's the idea that those words convey. If you only read the key words, you could cut the number of words you needed to read by at least 70%. This alone would triple or quadruple your reading speed. Remember, your purpose in reading is not to see every single word, but to comprehend the sense of the material and the key ideas. As you learned in the construction of memory maps, the key words are a small proportion or representation of the whole. The third problem that slows you down in reading is that the eye does not take in a line of print in a smooth movement. This is very important. Only the information reaching a specific and small area of the retina is really seen sharply. For this reason, your eye must stop for a fraction of a second to focus on a small amount of text as you read. Therefore, your eye movement is actually made up of a series of skips, like a ball bouncing along the line of print, stopping 4 or 5 times per line. The words around each of these points of fixation along the line are what is called your field of peripheral vision. Because you read in a series of skips or jerks, you're often tempted to backskip to check if you really saw or understood the previous words. This backskipping is common and probably cuts your reading speed down by at least a third. At this rate, you would struggle along at about 250 words per minute. You can really increase your reading speed in the next 20 minutes by carrying out the two following simple instructions. First, choose a book you want to read. A magazine or newspaper will do as well. Here is method number one. First, start reading each line of print, not at the very beginning of the line, but 2 or 3 words in from the beginning. Your peripheral vision and the redundant words will ensure that you miss no meaning. You'll grasp it all, even if you miss a couple of words at the beginning of the sentence. Second, finish reading the sentence 2 or 3 words from the end of the line. In this way, you will have reduced the amount of text you need to fixate on, and therefore increase your reading speed without sacrificing any comprehension. Third, add a physical aid by putting your hand flat on the page and move it forward and backward across the page in a sweeping motion, as if you were brushing crumbs off the page underneath the material that you are reading. Move your hand or your finger across and down the page in a sweep at a steady speed. Start to run your hand down the page at an ever-increasing speed. This speed must be much faster than you feel is really possible for you to register anything of what you are reading. Allow your eyes to follow the tips of your fingers down the page, but keep within the limits of your sweeping motion. Increase the speed until you are spending only 2 or 3 seconds per page. At this rate, you will initially perceive everything as a blur. Yet, if you persevere, you will find a strange thing happening. A few words will begin to stand out on each page, and they will be some of the key words. This will prove to you that your brain is actually processing much of the printed page, even though you're not registering it with your conscious mind, as you would if you were reading more slowly. Continue this simple speed training for 20 minutes. This is an absolutely essential part of the training, by the way. If you try it for just 2 or 3 minutes, you can't achieve the effect that you're looking for. Use a stopwatch or an alarm clock if necessary to discipline yourself to concentrate on this exercise. This high-speed training succeeds in 3 ways. First, it prevents any possibility of backskipping. Secondly, it starts to break your dependence on hearing the words in your head. You're now relying purely on visual reading, which is essential to achieving a really fast reading speed. The third effect of this exercise is comparable to the effect of driving on the freeway at a sustained speed. When you do start to slow down to a normal speed, you find that what you thought was 30 miles per hour is, in fact, 55 miles per hour or more. You will have altered your perception of speed with regard to reading as well. When you go back to reading at your normal speed, after 20 minutes of very high-speed reading, you will find that it is measurably faster than your previous speed. Power reading brings together the ideas and techniques of this session and combines them with some of the other learning techniques in earlier sessions. It consists of 8 steps. It is an invaluable process to learn for anyone who is under great pressure to keep up to date in their field. Here's how it works for a 250-page textbook made up of 10 chapters of 25 pages each. First, create the big picture of the book you are reading. Get an overview of the material. This should take approximately 5 to 10 minutes. Check the front material, then the back material, and then page quickly through from beginning to end. Ask some questions. Who is the author? The quality of a book depends more on who wrote it than what it says. When you skim, note the author's name, credentials, and prominence in the field. Read his or her biography. Check out the title. Make sure it's consistent with what you want to learn. What is the publication date? I bought a book once that had a modified cover on it, but which turned out to have been published 50 years ago and slipped back into print even though the material in it was hopelessly outdated. Look at the table of contents. Look at the chapter titles, headings, and subheadings. Examine the structure of the book to see how it's put together and to see if this book is for you in the first place. Finally, glance at the references and the index to see if there are key words and phrases that relate to your work. One of the fastest ways to save time in reading is to decide not to read the book at all because it's not a worthwhile use of your time. The second step in the power reading process is for you to preview the material. Scan read the text of the first chapter at the rate of about 7 seconds per page. Look for key facts and ideas. Look to see if this book will add to your knowledge. If it won't, you can abandon it early without wasting time. Being selective in what you read is one of the best routes to speed reading. The approximate time taken per chapter in previewing the material should be no more than 3 minutes per chapter, or a total of about 30 minutes for the book. The third step in the process is to stop and sketch out what you know. Write the question at the top of a page, "What do I already know about this subject?" And then write down everything you can think of that you know already before you read any further. This is a very important part of alerting your mind to what is coming. Sketching out what you know will take approximately 3 minutes per chapter, or a total of 30 minutes. Step 4 is for you to set up questions in your mind about the material. One of the keys to power reading is to read on purpose. The more clear you are about what you want to get out of a piece of reading, the more likely it is that you will retain the key ideas of the material. So ask questions like, what are the main ideas in this book? What supporting evidence is there? Are the facts up to date? Are the conclusions justified? What's new about this material? What can I use from this material? And what's in it for me in learning this material? This will take another 3 minutes per chapter, or a total of 30 minutes for the entire book. Step 5 is for you to read the text of each chapter, one chapter at a time. Go at a pace of about 15 to 20 seconds per page. At this stage, you can underline new ideas and put ticks, question marks, or exclamation marks in the margin. The approximate time taken per chapter for this exercise is about 8 minutes, or a total of about 80 minutes for a 10-chapter book. The sixth step is the afterview. Read back over the chapters, stopping at difficult sections and taking time to understand how the various ideas and arguments connect with each other. Look for the pattern to the argument or the material. Read aloud the parts that were difficult to understand. This dramatically helps comprehension. The probable time taken per chapter for this exercise is about 10 minutes. This is a total time for the 10-chapter book of about 100 minutes. The seventh step in the power reading process is for you to make your notes in a learning map form if possible. It will take you about 10 minutes per chapter, or a total of about 100 minutes, to make notes of the key points from the book. Finally, the eighth step in the power reading process is to review, something we have touched upon at great length in previous sessions. Spend 10 minutes the next day reviewing your notes, not the book. Spend another 5 to 10 minutes 1 week later, and a further 5 to 10 minutes a month later. The total time for this should be about 30 minutes for a total of 3 reviews. This multi-step way of reading should enable you to comprehend a 250-page textbook at a very high level for a total time expenditure of about 400 minutes, including making notes. This is approximately 6.5 hours for a serious, heavy-duty textbook. This time includes a lot of active reading, reviewing, and note-taking. Now, this is about twice as fast as most untrained people would read a 250-page textbook once. Yet, you would have reviewed the material at least 4 times and taken visually memorable notes. The amount that you would have memorized would have been between 4 times and 10 times as much as a normal student reading the book from cover to cover just once. If this sounds difficult or complicated, I strongly urge you to try it with one book, one time. The first time I learned this technique, by the way, I sat down with the book 1984 by George Orwell. I followed the technique from beginning to end and completed the entire book in just over 60 minutes. Then, I went back and reread the book the old way, line by line and chapter by chapter. It took me approximately 6 hours. What amazed me was that I did not pick up or learn a single key idea, concept, fact, or part of the plot that I had not gotten from my 60-minute reading earlier. Power reading techniques have tremendous implications for your life and your career. Power reading is an efficient way of searching for ideas without getting bogged down by reading every word with equal attention. How fast you read depends on why you are reading. Power reading is variable speed reading. You vary the speed depending on the difficulty of the material and the importance of your in-depth comprehension of it. You should make up an index card with the 8 steps in the sequence of power reading. They are 1. Overview, skim and scan the entire book. 2. Preview, glance quickly through each chapter. 3. Sketch out what you know about the subject. 4. Create questions so that you read on purpose when you begin. 5. Read for key ideas. 6. Afterview for the pattern of the material and the difficult ideas. 7. Make notes and learning maps. And 8. Review the material the next day, the next week, and the next month. Keep using this sequence until it becomes a habit. It's a sequence that many successful learners use already. There are several other key ideas that you can use with regard to power reading and getting through the information overload that is probably bogging you down right now. First, read only the material that is interesting and important to you. If it's not immediately relevant to your life or work, it may be enjoyable to read, but you will neither remember it nor will you get anything of value from it. It requires tremendous discipline for you to refuse to begin reading something that's not helpful to you at the moment. But the only way that you can read more important things is to consciously refuse to read less important things. Use the skim and scan, overview and preview method to read magazines and newsletters, as well as newspapers. Start with the table of contents of a magazine, for example, and circle only those articles that you feel will be of interest to you. Don't read the magazine the way it's been printed. This design is to draw you past as many advertisements as possible, and it causes you to trip over articles of marginal interest that are designed to grab your attention. Using your table of contents as your base of operations, go straight to the articles that are relevant to you at this moment. Even better, practice the rip and read method. This requires that you go straight to the article and rip it out. Once you have torn out all the articles that are immediately relevant to you, throw the rest of the magazine away. Put the various articles in a file and then carry the file with you to read when you have open times in your schedule. Always read with a colored pen or highlighter. Don't be afraid to mark up the material extensively. Everything that you can do to explore or play with the material, to underline it or highlight it, to mark it with question marks or exclamation marks will increase your likelihood of remembering that information later. The most important part of learning, the activity that clinches the material into your long-term memory, is the period of reflection and paraphrasing that you go through as you stop and reflect while you read. Whenever I'm reading something important, I stop and repeat the key points over to myself and reread them in the magazine or article to make sure I got them right. You'll be amazed at how much more you will recall when you take a few moments to reflect on the material as you go through it. We're going to talk now about power writing, which is a vital skill that can help you immeasurably in your work and your personal life. The better you can write, the better you can think, And the better you can think, the more you will accomplish. The better decisions you will make, and the more rapidly you will move ahead in your work. The better you write, the more respect and esteem you will earn from others. The better you write, the more control you will have over your economic destiny. To write well, you have to concentrate first on the what, and then on the how. Content comes before style. Substance comes before form. Here's the secret. What you write is largely a function of your creativity. To write in an interesting way, you need to free your brain's creative powers. The problem is that most people expect to write creatively and to edit what they're writing both at the same time. The result is that writing becomes stressful and stilted. The secret is to write quickly and fluently, and then, after you have finished your first draft, if you need to, allow yourself to criticize and edit your writing. Mark Twain put it well. He said, "If we taught children to speak the way we teach them to write, everyone would stutter." He probably meant that because we expect our writing to be perfect straight away, we are often unable to write with natural fluency and ease. When we were learning to write, we were given a whole series of grammatical rules and graded down if we didn't follow them on our school assignments. With that kind of advice, it's a wonder that anyone can manage to write, even in a stutter. What we now know is that to write and to edit what you have written should be two separate functions. When you try to combine them in one simultaneous activity, writing becomes a drag, and eventually you'll avoid doing it altogether. But when you separate writing and editing into two parts, writing becomes a real pleasure. One of the most powerful techniques for effective writing is something that we have already learned, the creation of learning maps. If you have a subject on which you need to write, try this sequence of preparation. First, look up your previous notes, which might even be in a learning map form by this time. Second, go to whatever additional reference books you need and make any extra notes you require. Third, put the subject of your article or chapter in the middle of a blank page. Fourth, now allow your mind the luxury of free association. Just write down on a page all the ideas and words that come to mind. Let the ideas branch out as they form in your head. Do this for 15 minutes. It's vital to keep going after you seem to have run out of ideas. This is because your original ideas will be the most obvious ones. If you stop too early, you will only have captured the more mundane thoughts. The best guarantee of having good ideas is to have lots of ideas. This free-flow stage of mind mapping is called brainstorming. Put down all the ideas, even apparently silly ideas. This is because the irrelevant ideas can be stepping stones to truly creative ones. Fifth, sit back and look at your map. See how the various ideas are connected and associated with each other. Sixth, start a new creative map. This time, group related ideas together in bigger clusters. Each bigger cluster will be a theme that you will develop. This use of learning maps, constantly redrawn, will dramatically improve the creativity and quality of what you write. With the organized map of your subject in front of you, start to write your essay, report, communication, or speech. One of the most important rules for effective writing is this: just write. Don't worry about style, spelling, grammar, or punctuation. Allow your semi-organized thoughts to flow down the paper. Write up one cluster of ideas and then move on to the next. Go as quickly as you can until you've finished. Refrain from judging, criticizing, or editing. Just write. On occasion, you might have what is called writer's block. This is when your words and ideas simply won't flow onto the paper. An excellent way to break this block is to just begin writing anything, even individual letters. You will find that gradually the thoughts begin to take shape and make sense. The physical act of writing seems to relax your attention. And now you're ready for the second stage, and this is to do nothing. The truth is that good writing involves about 40% research, 20% writing, and 40% revision. During stage two, when you were pouring everything out on paper, you will have rather enjoyed yourself. You will probably expect to reread your literary efforts and be quite proud of what you've written. The bad news is that you will probably reread what you've written the first time and think it is rubbish. Indeed, if you're like me or anyone else, it will probably be in need of a lot of help. This is because your first effort was really only a draft. No one has ever written anything of value without at least one rewrite. Abraham Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, which was supposedly written on the back of an envelope on the way to Gettysburg to give the speech, turned out to have been the result of more than 6 months of writing and rewriting on Lincoln's part. He had tested out various words and phrases from the talk in both speeches and letters. He merely crystallized the result of an enormous amount of hard work on the day before the actual speech. If anything you write is going to be good, expect to rewrite it several times. For example, when I write a book, article, or script, I know that I have to rewrite it 5 times if it's going to read well on paper. Anything less than 5 rewrites for me, and sometimes more, is not sufficient to write good material. The whole point of your earlier free-flow writing session was to make the material spontaneous. This means that it won't be perfect, but it won't be stilted either. You now need a period where you switch off thinking about the subject consciously. You need a period of incubation. During this quiet time, your subconscious mind will probably be filling in missing sections and remembering extra points. It may also be working on ways of expressing what you really meant. It's another example of the power of reflection, which we talked about earlier. Now you're finally prepared for the edit session. After a break, overnight at least, if not longer, you can return to your writing. This is the time to be conscious about style. Now you can be critical about your writing. You'll probably find that early in the morning is an excellent time to start editing. The day has not yet crowded out the potential contributions from your subconscious mind. When you edit, approach it as if you were reading it through the eyes of a stranger. Is the meaning clear? Is there a flow to the writing? Do you tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you've told them? In other words, do you set up your basic argument or point, then prove it, then conclude it with a short summary? Do you give the big picture, the details, and then the overview? This is, by the way, a satisfying shape or style for most subjects. The words should also be satisfying. It helps for you to read out loud what you have written. If you find yourself tripping over something that you have written or feeling uncomfortable or awkward, go back and stroke it out and replace it with words that flow more smoothly. Your aim should be that your reader feels that you are communicating directly to him or her. Remember, the speakers speak to audiences, but writers speak to a single person. The very best writing comes off the page as if it were written by one friend to another. Good writing mostly has a conversational tone to it. Of course, for some subjects at school or university, a more formal style may be appropriate, but don't confuse sounding serious with being stuffy. In good writing, especially in letter writing or business writing, you should be natural, be personal, be brief, and grab them in the first line. You only have one chance to make a good first impression. Your opening line and your opening paragraph sets the tone for everything that follows. Consider rewriting only after your whole letter or report is finished. The average person sees hundreds of advertising messages each day. In addition, they read thousands of words of newspapers, magazines, and articles, and they hear thousands of more words on the television and radio. All this bombardment leads to a high degree of clutter or competition for the attention of what you are writing. If your writing stands any chance of grabbing your reader's attention, it must stand out from all these conflicting messages. Here are 7 rules that you or anyone can use to be a far more effective writer. Rule 1. Consider your audience carefully. Who are they? What do they expect from you? What are they interested in? When you can answer that question, you begin to define the style, shape, and length of your letter, article, or report. What's in it for them? What can you do to make it relevant and important for your reader at the moment? Rule number 2 is to grab them by the throat. The fact is that most people are too busy to read what you have written. They may give you the benefit of the doubt during the first paragraph, but after that, they are swamped with work just as you are. You therefore have about 30 seconds to grab their attention and to lure them willingly into what you've written. So, make the first few words count. In fact, some research indicates that it is the first 11 to 15 words that determines the person's attitude to everything that follows. Take the time to make those words personal, poignant, relevant, and emotive. Rule number 3 is to give them a reason to be interested. The reader will always want to know, what will this do for me? Remember, you don't write for yourself, you write for the reader. The only thing the reader cares about is how he or she might benefit from what you've written. Will it solve a problem or benefit him or her in some way? So write from the reader's point of view. This is not true just of sales letters, by the way. It's true of all letters. Here are 2 good examples. First, the poor example of a sales letter. It starts off by saying, "Further to our recent telephone conversation with your good selves, we have pleasure in enclosing our brochure describing our exciting range of self-tapping, bronze-plated, rigids, etc., etc." This sort of writing is boring and turns off the reader. Here's an alternative that is far more effective. It starts, "Rust costs your company a lot of money each year, and it causes accidents. You can save money right now by using our bronze-plated widgets. They cost no more, and they're self-tapping, too." This version sets up a problem that the reader cares about and then solves it. It is directed at the reader in natural, personal language. Rule number 4 is to keep it short. People respond best to short sentences. With a long sentence, it's all too easy to forget what was said at the beginning, so you lose track and get bored or irritated. A general rule for editing is that you can tighten up the original draft by 1/3 to 1/2. The Ten Commandments take up just 297 words. The Gettysburg Address required 287 words. People remember punchy sentences. It's at the revision stage, after a period of incubation, that most of the great lines of history are crafted. John Kennedy said, "Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country." Martin Luther King is famous for his words, "I have a dream that my children will live in a nation where they are judged by the content of their character rather than by the color of their skin." A test of good writing is how pleasurable it is to read. Rule number 5 is always choose the simplest, most familiar word that conveys your meaning accurately. Avoid lawyer's language. Instead of using words like expeditious, use the word quick. Instead of using the words in the event of, use the word if. Instead of using the words due to the fact that, use the word because. Use concrete words rather than abstract words. That makes it easier for your reader to visualize or to learn what you have written. Always talk in the reader's language and keep it punchy. Rule number 6 is to make it look inviting. Use underlinings, italics, and quotation marks. Use quotes that are punchy, relevant, and have a ring to them. Break up passages with headings and subheadings. Use expressions like, "just imagine," or "have you ever thought?" This activates the reader's brain and gets them moving along with you. Keep the reader interested with short paragraphs, bullet points, subheadings, and examples. Make it fun and easy to read. Finally, rule number 7 is to close with a bang. You have opened with an attention grabber. You have deliberately used basic words, short sentences, and active verbs. You have, above all, written to interest the reader. You've written as if it were a personal communication from you to him or her. All you need now is a punchy close. A strong close can often be a relevant quote. It will almost always be a sentence, or at most a short paragraph that summarizes the theme of what you have said. Remember that what you say at the close often remains in the reader's mind longer than anything else. Here are the 7 keys to powerful writing once more. Take them and put them on an index card so that you can review them often and you can compare anything you write from a paragraph to a book against them. First, make it appropriate for your audience. Think about the person who will be reading it and write it directly to that person. Second, grab his or her attention in the opening sentence and the opening paragraph. Charles Dickens started one of his most famous books with the words, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." Herman Melville started his classic Moby Dick with the words, "Call me Ishmael." Make the language active and direct rather than passive and roundabout. Number three is to give them a reason to be interested. Number four, make your sentences reasonably short and clear. This makes them easier and more enjoyable to understand. Number five, use the simplest words possible. The basic rule is that you never use several words or a longer word when fewer words or shorter words will convey the same point. Number six is to make your writing look inviting. Make it attractive and enjoyable to read. Other than that, it will be put aside or even thrown away because of the overwhelming amount of other reading material coming in the door at the same time. And rule number seven for power writing is to close your written material with a bang. If it's a business letter or publication, close it with a call to action or a commitment to take action of some kind on your part. By following the techniques and ideas contained in this session, you can become both a power reader and a power writer. You can greatly increase your communication skills and your level of personal effectiveness in everything you do. By combining these ideas with what you are learning about accelerated learning, you will be using your mind and your abilities in a higher and better way than ever before. The German philosopher Goethe once wrote, "A person can develop any quality at all in solitude, except character. Character can only be developed in constant interaction with other people." You can learn everything you need to know, and you can learn how to learn any subject fluently and well, but in the final analysis, your ability to personally communicate and interact effectively with other people will be more important to you than everything else put together. Your ability to communicate with others will account for fully 85% of your success, both at work and in your personal life. Just think about it. Good communicators are happier, healthier, and better paid. They are more powerful, persuasive, and esteemed by other people. In a world where no one does anything alone, and everything that anyone wants to get done requires the cooperation of lots of people, good communicators seem to rise to the top of any organization of value. Among all the intelligences that we discussed earlier, interpersonal intelligence is perhaps the highest paid in our society. This is the ability to negotiate, communicate, persuade, influence, and get along with the greatest number of people. As John Nesbitt wrote in his book Megatrends, "As we move into the area of high tech, we are moving simultaneously toward high touch." The faster things change and the more technologically complex our society becomes, the more valued will be people who are excellent at working with and cooperating with others. As products become more complicated, the most successful salespeople will be those who are the most capable of building and maintaining long-term, high-quality relationships with their customers. The most effective managers are those who are the most competent at assembling a group of people into an effective work team to get the job done in an excellent fashion. These managers are good at selecting the right people, deploying their strengths and abilities strategically in the best interest of the group, delegating properly, supervising effectively, giving feedback clearly, and motivating them to work at their best. The very best parents are those who are the most capable of expressing themselves clearly, listening well, and practicing kindness, consideration, and courtesy with the members of their families. Single people who are good communicators are more successful in dating, and married people who are good communicators have longer-lasting and happier marriages. There's no part of life where other people are involved that becoming a better communicator cannot help you to be a more successful and effective person. Wonderfully enough, good communicators are made, not born. Communication skills are like almost any other skills. Everyone has them to a certain degree and can therefore develop them as extensively as they want. It's merely a matter of desire, application, and persistence. And the more effective you become as a communicator, the happier you will be in every part of your life. There are three basic parts of any conversation between two or more people. The ancient Greeks called these ethos, pathos, and logos. The ethos or ethics referred to the character of the individual in the conversation or interaction with others. As Emerson wrote, "What you are shouts at me so loudly, I can't hear a word you say." Everything we do in our interactions with others affects the way they see us, think about us, and respond to us. It's almost as if we live in a goldfish bowl where everyone can see us clearly, and it's very hard for us to ever appear as anything other than the people we really are. This is why the Greeks put such an emphasis on character education and character development as the most important parts of training young people. Everything that we do to build our characters by practicing courage, honesty, persistence, and self-discipline makes us more effective and influential in our interactions with others. The second part of any conversation is called pathos, which refers to the emotional content of the communication. When you use pathos, you attempt to connect with the emotions of the other person. You deal with them on the feeling level. You talk to them about the things that cause them to respond at a deeper level. When you ask a person about how he or she feels, or about their life or their family, you connect with the pathos. Since human beings are completely emotional, each person is motivated and influenced most strongly by an appeal to their emotions of some kind. The third part of conversation is the logos, or the logical content of the message. This is often the least influential of all in communicating with others. Many doctors today are finding that they can be perfectly correct from an ethical and logical point of view in the way they treat their patients, but their patients can still become angry with them because of their apparent cold and unfeeling treatment. In any advertisement, for a product or service to be sold effectively, all three parts of the message must exist. The company must establish its ethos or its character and credibility. The advertisement must connect with the emotions or the deep inner needs of the viewer or reader. Finally, the message must present a logical explanation of how the product or service can satisfy the needs of the prospective customer. When you communicate with other people, it's important that you think about how your character and ethical qualities are perceived by others. As you know, in influencing and persuading anyone of anything, your level of credibility is usually the critical factor. If you want to be influential with others, you have to pay attention to their real feelings and concerns. The logos, or logical part of any argument, seems to come last, and it is only listened to when the ethos and pathos are clear. In communicating more powerfully and effectively with others, you always have to be aware of the different personality styles that people have. These personality styles, which are largely genetic and inborn, determine how people think, feel, and respond to you. The major mistake that most people make is that they attempt to relate to everyone else the way they are, rather than the way other people are. The golden rule says to do unto others as you would have them do unto you. My friend Tony Alessandra says that the platinum rule in human relations is to do unto others the way they want to be done unto. Treat them the way they want to be treated. Personality styles can be divided into four kinds along two scales. The first scale, running east to west, is from indirect to direct. An indirect person is a person who is more introverted, quieter, self-contained, and not particularly expressive. A direct person at the other end of the spectrum is a person who is extroverted, outspoken, and direct in their communications with others. The other spectrum, running north and south, is between a high concern for people and their feelings on the one end and a high concern for the task and for getting the job done on the other end. You can use these four ends of the two scales to create four different personality styles. The first personality style consists of people who are indirect and intensely people-oriented. These people have the relator style of personality. They are generally soft-spoken, easygoing, very sensitive to other people, and most concerned with being liked and getting along well with other people. They're extremely sensitive to the opinions of others, and they will not make decisions until they are sure that everyone who is affected by the decision agrees with it and is satisfied. The second personality style is made up of the person who is indirect and intensely task-oriented. These people are called analyzers. They are very detail-oriented and more concerned with accuracy than anything else. They ask a lot of questions, and they're very concerned about numbers and facts and details. They're not particularly people-oriented or outgoing, but they make excellent accountants, computer programmers, engineers, and Other people who work most effectively in professions where accuracy and controls are of paramount importance. The third type of personality is the director type. This person is very high on task orientation and low on people orientation, as well as being direct and outspoken. Directors can even become dictators and autocrats. They are intensely result-oriented. They're impatient, and they want to know the bottom line immediately. These are the kind of people you put in charge when you want to get results quickly. They make excellent salespeople, sales managers, fire chiefs, combat officers, production managers, and so on. Their primary concern is results, and they're often insensitive to the feelings of others in the pursuit of results. The fourth personality type is the socializer. This is a person who is high on people orientation and is direct and outgoing as well. This person is very achievement-oriented and likes to talk and brainstorm creatively about all kinds of subjects. He or she will ask you a lot of questions about yourself and will very much enjoy talking about his or her accomplishments. This person loves to be the center of attention and is often hard to nail down and forgetful when they make commitments. In order to be effective with these different personalities, you need to practice what is called style flexibility. When you're dealing with a relator, you need to be quieter, more patient, and more sensitive to his or her feelings. When you're dealing with an analyzer, you need to be more accurate and fastidious about your details. When you're dealing with a director, you need to cut through the chafe and get to the bottom line quickly. When you're dealing with a socializer, you need to ask them a lot of questions about themselves and be positive and outgoing yourself as well. In every interpersonal situation, here is the most important rule you will learn for conversation. It is that the person who asks questions has control. Whenever you ask questions of another person, they will almost invariably answer or feel compelled to answer. We've been taught from childhood to answer when we are spoken to. When you ask a person a question, even if they don't speak aloud, in fact, they will answer the question to themselves. For example, let me ask you a question. If you could go anywhere in the world for a 2-week vacation, all expenses paid, where would it be? Where would you like to go? What would you like to do when you went there? When would you like to go there? You probably noticed that when I asked you that question, your mind flew immediately to the answer. This is a normal and automatic response for virtually everyone. So when you ask questions, you have complete control of the conversation until he or she has answered the question, one way or another. When you ask questions, it's the equivalent of grabbing the other person by the lapels of their jacket and jerking them toward you. Questions arrest and hold attention. Questions are the most powerful form of communications technique if you want to strongly influence other people. There are three types of questions that you can use to be more effective in any conversation, either in your personal life, in sales, or in management. The first type of questions are called open-ended questions. These are questions that start with the pronouns who, how, what, where, when, and why. Two of the most powerful questions that you can ask a person when you meet them for the first time are, first of all, what sort of work do you do? This is a nice, general, easy question to answer. And since everyone is fascinated by their own work and their own careers, almost anyone will answer you to some degree. After they have told you what sort of work they do, you can follow up with an even more powerful question, like a 1-2 punch, by asking, how did you get into that line of work anyway? Again, since everyone feels that their line of work and their career path is fascinating, they will probably tell you in greater detail about how they finally ended up doing what they're doing today. If a person slows down in their description of themselves and their discussion of their career, you can keep the plate spinning or the ball rolling in the conversation by asking occasionally, and then what did you do? And then what did you do? In sales and social conversations, these three questions, what sort of work do you do? How did you get into that line of work anyway? And then what did you do? We'll keep a conversation rolling on and on. You can also ask other questions like, why did you decide to do it that way? When did you begin that particular course of action? Where do you live, or where did you come from, and so on? Open-ended questions are questions that require an extended answer. They can't be answered with a simple yes or no. And the more of them you ask, the more of an opportunity you get to listen to the answers. And the more you listen to people talk about things that are of great interest to them, such as their past and present career path, the more they consider you to be a wonderful conversationalist and the more open they are to being influenced by you at a later time. The second type of questions you can ask are closed-ended questions. These are questions that begin with verbs. These are questions that must be answered with a yes or a no. They force people to take a position. For example, you can ask a question like, "Do you like working here?" Or, "Are you going to be making a decision within the next 30 days? Or, "Have you decided if you are going to do this or that?" And so on. Whenever you want to begin a conversation or a relationship, you use open-ended questions. Whenever you want to bring about some kind of conclusion, you use closed-ended questions. In both cases, you have control of the conversation for as long as it takes the other person to answer the question. Another characteristic of power communications is balanced dialogue, which consists of an easy ebb and flow of conversation back and forth between the two parties. The best conversationalists practice the 70-30 rule. They listen 70% of the time and they talk only 30% of the time or less. They never try to dominate the conversation by speaking louder, faster, or continuously. They allow easy silences in the conversation. They ask questions and they listen patiently while the other person formulates answers. They never say more than 3 sentences in a row without stopping and giving the other person a chance to comment. If the conversation is lagging for any reason, or if they feel they have been talking too much, they stop and ask open-ended questions to get the conversation going again. The very best communicators practice unconditional positive regard in their interactions with others. This is a term from psychology, and it is used in psychotherapy. It simply means that, no matter what the other person says, you continue to react in a positive and supportive way. You don't become angry or upset. You never react or express any kind of negative emotion. You continue to smile, nod, agree, and empathize with the other person's situation. One of the primary reasons that people go to professional psychotherapists is just to find someone with whom they can unburden themselves of problems and worries that are causing them a good deal of distress. In many cases, they feel badly about something they've done or said or something that has happened to them. They feel ashamed and often guilty when it comes to talking about these things. They need to be able to converse with someone who will simply listen to what they have to say without reacting or passing judgment of any kind. With your friends and family, you can be an excellent psychotherapist by simply asking questions about how they feel and how things are going for them, and then by listening patiently and non-judgmentally to the answers. In the Bible it says, "Judge not, that ye be not judged." This is an admonition to refrain from judgment whenever possible. It is one of the kindest and most helpful things you can do in human relationships, and one of the ways that makes you a powerful and influential communicator in your interactions with others. Excellent communicators also acknowledge and confirm twice the average of average or poor communicators. They face the other person directly when they're talking and look directly into his or her face. They nod, smile, and agree, making noises like yes and uh-huh and so on. They listen and converse actively with their whole body and mind involved in the conversation. When you're talking to another person and you face them squarely and pay very close attention to what they're saying and how they're saying it, you exert a tremendous influence over them. You hear them and understand them much better as well. You pick up subtle cues and nuances of conversation. It has been said that rapt attention is the highest form of flattery. You really make another person feel good about himself or herself when you focus intently on them during a conversation and gently smile and nod while they're expressing themselves. Power communicators have high levels of empathy with other people, and they're extremely sensitive to them and their feelings. They try to put themselves in the other person's position. Instead of ignoring and downplaying another's concerns or feelings, they imagine how they might feel if the tables were turned. One of the most powerful of all expressions you can use for dealing with other people who are unhappy for any reason is to acknowledge and say, "I understand exactly how you feel. If I was in your position, I'd feel exactly the same way." As much as anything else, people need to feel that other people understand them and are making a genuine effort to empathize with their particular position or situation. When you say, I understand exactly how you feel. If I were in your position, I'd feel the same way. You send a powerful message that causes people to like, respect, and look up to you. This makes them much more open and amenable to you in your attempts to influence and persuade them at a later time. The most important point in all this is that listening builds trust, and trust is the basis of all relationships between people. The essence of ethos, the character of the speaker, is contained in the degree to which the listener trusts and believes in the words that he or she speaks. Individuals are like human lie detectors. They are extremely sensitive to any incongruity between the words, the message, and the person. They're always looking for contradictions as a way of protecting themselves from being misled or deceived. Now, there are three ingredients to any message or communication between two people. According to Dr. Albert Mehrabian of the University of California in Los Angeles, the words that you use in a communication only account for 7% of the message. Your tone of voice and your facial expressions account for 38% of the message that the other person receives. And your body language, the way you sit, stand, walk, talk, and move, accounts for fully 55% of your message. And the rule is that people believe the dominant part of the message more than they believe any other part. For example, if you're sitting with a person with your arms folded, turned away from them, and looking up toward the ceiling, it's very hard for you to convince them with words that you really like them or care about them, no matter what you say. It is only when your words, your tone of voice, and your body language are synchronized and in harmony with each other that a person absorbs and believes the totality of the message that you are sending. When you take the time to listen carefully to another person, the other person will trust you more and believe in you and what you have to say. The most powerful communicators in our society just happen to be those who are believed by the greatest number of people. On the other hand, a person loses their power in any communication when the listeners lose their confidence in the character and integrity of the person. Listening skills are essential to success with other people. There have been many books written on listening, and there are 2- and 3-day courses that you can take on the subject. I've spent many years studying it myself, and I've boiled down the keys to listening to 4 vital points. First, listen attentively to the other person. Listen completely without interrupting or attempting to interrupt. Listen as if the other person were the only other person in the world. Hang on every word. Lean forward, nod, smile, and focus all of your attention on the other person's face, eyes, and mouth. It's absolutely amazing the power you can exert over another person by listening to them with complete fascination. Professional salespeople have found that they can turn an angry, indifferent, or negative prospect or customer around completely by the simple act of listening single-mindedly to that person while he or she expresses himself or herself. The second key listening skill is to pause before replying. When the other person stops talking, deliberately wait for 3 to 5 seconds before you say anything. This will have one or more of 3 effects. First of all, when you pause, you actually hear the other person better. The words they have just finished saying will soak into a deeper level of your mind, and you'll understand them better. Therefore, when you do reply, it will be a much more intelligent reply than if you began speaking immediately after the other person stopped. The second advantage of pausing before replying is that you demonstrate to the other person that you are really giving what they have said careful consideration before you come out with an answer. This is extremely flattering to another person, and it only takes a 3 to 5 second pause to convince them that what they have said is important and meaningful to you. The third benefit of pausing before replying is that if the other person has merely stopped to gather his or her thoughts, you avoid the possibility of interrupting him or her in the middle of a thought. People who pause before replying come across as graceful, elegant, and classy conversationalists. The third key listening skill is to question for clarification. Never assume that you fully understand what the other person has said or the key points that he or she has made. Especially in sales or dealing with people on complex issues, always question for clarification before you begin to reply or to give your own point of view. The very best question I've ever learned for this part of listening is, how do you mean exactly? Since people often say things that are only half-formed, and they come out in a different way than the way that they actually meant it, when you ask the question, "How do you mean?" you give the person a chance to rephrase what he or she has said and express it in a different way. Often you'll find that the second statement is very different from what you thought you heard the first time. The fourth key listening skill is to feed it back to the other person by paraphrasing it in your own words. The ability to paraphrase is a key communication skill and a powerful learning skill as well. When a person finishes speaking, you can say something like this: "Let me make sure I understood you clearly. What you seem to be saying is this." And then you go on to paraphrase what the person has just said in your own words. Now, one of two things can happen. First, the other person can say, "No, that's not what I meant to say," and then go on to explain it differently. Or second, the person can say, "Yes, you've got it. That's what I'm trying to say." In this case, he or she will be very flattered when you demonstrate that you are really paying attention by feeding it back to him or her in such a way that they agree that you fully understood. It seems that on the way up, we do a lot more talking in our attempts to impress and influence people than we do when we get to the top. I've worked with extremely wealthy and influential men and women who almost universally tend to be very low-keyed, good questioners, and good listeners as well. They seem to be beyond the point of wanting to impress or influence other people directly, and they instead do it by asking good questions and listening intently to the answers. The final part of power communications is what is called the friendship factor. All success, all power, all influence of a lasting nature in our society is based on friendship of some kind. The more people like you and believe in you, the more open they are to be influenced by you. The more open they are to helping you when you need help, the more they will open doors for you, lend you money, give you information, and recommend key people to you at key times. The most powerful men and women in any city, any state, or in our national society are invariably those men and women who are known to and known by, in a friendly way, the greatest number of other powerful and influential people. In fact, here's a simple way for you to change your life. Over the course of the next few months, by reading the newspapers, watching the television, and talking to people, assemble a list of the 100 most important and influential people in your community. Open a set of files on these people or program them into your computer. Then make a plan to meet and get to know and to be known by every one of these people over the next couple of years. This is far easier than you can imagine. I have personally met 3 presidents of the United States, 4 prime ministers of Canada, the prime minister of Bermuda, countless millionaires and multimillionaires, and 3 billionaires over the course of my career. And almost all of them were as the direct result of making a plan and then working that plan. Activating the friendship factor in your life requires time, caring, and respect. With regard to time, you can write them a letter, send them an article, send them a fax of congratulations on something they're doing or that they've done, or even send them a gift of some kind. You can join the associations and organizations to which they belong. You can join their political parties and volunteer to work on their campaigns. You can contribute small amounts to charities they support and attend fundraising functions for the charities that they're involved in. The number of different ways that you can get involved with and eventually meet the men and women you respect and esteem are limited only by your imagination. You will find over time, by the way, that the most important people in your life are the people who you like and who like you in the same way. Invariably, your friendly relationships are based on time, caring, and respect. In fact, the value of any relationship to you is a function of the amount of time that you invest in it. The more time you invest in a relationship, the more valuable it can become. Caring appeals to the pathos part of human nature, to the emotions of the person. When people feel that you genuinely care about them and their situations, they're far more open to being influenced by you and to helping you in some way at a later time. And the final key, respect, is something that little children cry for and grown men die for. Napoleon Bonaparte once said, I have discovered a remarkable thing. Men will die for ribbons. He had found that men who would never think of risking their lives for money would put themselves in harm's way for medals and ribbons that would earn them the respect of their officers and fellow soldiers. Everyone is concerned about earning and keeping the respect of others that they respect. When you express your respect and esteem for another person, that other person is always influenced by it in some way. Many people have decided that they need to be more effective in their relationships with others, and they have set it as a learning project over a period of a year or two. They have taken courses that help them to know and understand themselves better so that they could know and understand others better as well. They have listened to audio cassettes and read books instructing them in some of the things that they could do more of, or less of, in order to be more effective in their interactions with others. They have used the accelerated learning techniques talked about in the previous sessions to create affirmations, visualizations, and emotionalizations that enable them to learn and internalize the new behaviors that they desired. Over time, and usually not a long time, they have become more positive, more personable, and more influential in all their relationships with other people. And since there's such a direct correlation between interpersonal intelligence and skills and personal success in life, many aspects of their lives have improved as well. When you become more effective in your communications, you will become better at cooperative or team learning, learning that takes place when you work jointly with others to master a particular subject. You will become better at selling, managing, and parenting. You become a better friend and a better employee. You become a more competent and confident person overall. When you become a power communicator, every other part of your life opens up in front of you in a more exciting and positive way.